We have no relationships to disclose with for this presentation. I'm going to actually start us out. I'm going to do a really high-level overview of the Joint Commission's newly proposed standards that would go into effect, I believe, January 2011 for culturally competent patient-centered care. If you want more information about those standards, this is the link that you can go to, and they have there at that link this roadmap for hospitals that you can download and learn a bit about the Joint Commission's standards. Then I'm going to turn things over to Rob, who's going to talk a bit about the background and why it is that we recommend a systems-based approach. And Sandy's presentation actually was a beautiful illustration of what a systems approach to cultural competence is. And then I'm going to close a bit with a description about what it is the National Center for Healthcare Leadership had recommended in terms of a gap analysis for addressing the Joint Commission standards. So first, the overview of the standards. Another link here for the actual standards that are currently proposed themselves. First, the standards are requiring qualified language interpreters and translators, but they're leaving open the how one might demonstrate qualifications, and through things like language proficiency assessment, education, training, and experiences. In the case of every one of these standards and practices, there won't affect accreditation initially. They'll be part of the standards, they'll be assessed, but they won't influence whether or not an organization actually gets accredited at the beginning. It is certainly my hope that in the short, long run, that they will. Second, effective communication with patients regarding care, treatment, and services. The notion is that it's the customer-driven, it's the patient's preferences that should drive the preferred language for discussing their health care, and that the approach to communicating ought to be one that meets the patient's needs, as stated by the patients, not as perceived by the caregiver. Racial, ethnic, and other demographic data now will be required to be collected, including the patient's race and ethnicity. And many of you probably already know that the American Hospital Association's HRET has developed a wonderful methodology for being able to collect these data in a way that patients will understand their use and won't be threatened by that data collection. There are also other new data elements that will need to be collected, including gender, the patient's communication needs, including their preferred language, and the legal status of patients receiving behavioral health services. Perhaps one of you knows. I am clueless about why that is. I don't know why that might be a data point. Another new standard has to do with respect for patient rights. And in this, I certainly see diversity broadly defined. And this addresses some of the concerns that gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender patients have had in terms of being able to have their family member, their partner, be in control of their care and get all of the rights that family members get in more traditional families. So the notion is that the individual of your choice, who is your family, your significant other, can be there to provide emotional support during your stay, and that the hospital will not discriminate based on all the characteristics listed on this slide. And I'm going to turn things over to Rob now, who's going to talk a bit about the background and why we believe that even with these limited standards, you have to take a systems approach to be able to address them appropriately.
Yes, thank you, Jan. Yes, so these standards are wonderful, but it's important to remember the context in which the care is being delivered, and that it has to be a systems approach, that it's not only affecting the frontline workers, but also all the way from the leadership top management all the way down. Now, before I talk a little bit about the evidence about the systems approach, I'm sure this audience knows about that we have evidence about racial ethnic disparities in terms of access, treatment, outcomes. But there is also another side to disparities, and it's the whole human resources aspect that oftentimes minorities in the workforce are less satisfied, there's higher turnover, and so this is another area that has to be addressed as we think about a systems approach, because we definitely want to have a workforce that mirrors the patient population. And there are, of course, a lot of definitions for cultural competence. There is a recent one that has been developed by the National Quality Forum that defines cultural competency as the ongoing capacity of healthcare systems, organizations, and professionals to provide for diverse patient populations high-quality care that is safe, patient and family-centered, evidence-based, and equitable. Now, this definition, the importance is that it goes beyond the traditional focus on just the clinician, patient, but it also goes into where the care is being provided or the systems of care. Also pay attention to the words ongoing capacity. So it's not like we become culturally competent and that's it, right? It has to be an ongoing process where we revisit where we are and we continuously improve. And the whole word about capacity, which can be actually achieved by having the policies, learning processes, as well as structures by which organizations can basically implement these strategies. Now, what is diversity leadership? Well, we're talking about a commitment of the top management, but not just the top management, but all the way down in the organization, because you have, of course, leaders at all levels of the organization. It's not just the top management. So you need to have the commitment from all levels of the organization in terms of who are the leaders in terms of implementing these types of activities in order for diversity management really to be infused through the organization. Now, if you think about it, there's differences across organizations, and ultimately you can think about diversity leadership as a strategy that organizations can choose in order to differentiate themselves from other organizations. So we have a patient population that is diverse. We should do something about that. We should do something better than our competitors. So you can think about it as a strategic positioning of organizations. So that's why we call it strategic diversity leadership. Now, does it matter? Diversity leadership, does it matter? We know that it matters in terms of when you have leaders that are committed, and we had an instrument where we assess diversity-sensitive orientation by asking leaders in terms of their perspective or in terms of what they consider the importance of the customer diversity as an important driver of strategy, but also the workforce demographics, whether they should reflect the customer demographics. And we found that when leaders thought that these dimensions were important, and they also had an external orientation, again, paying attention to the market, what's happening outside the organization, they also were more engaged in cultural competency and diversity management activities, which would not be surprising. But the key element is, again, that you need to have that commitment from the top management. Another way of looking at it in terms of diversity leadership, ultimately you can ask leaders, are you committed? And, you know, there's always that bias that everyone may say that they are committed, but you also need to have concrete evidence that it's actually shown. And we came up with four areas, and actually this developed from the CCATH, the Cultural Competency Assessment Tool for Hospitals, that Guadalupe Pacheco helped us a lot in funding this instrument. And in terms of leadership, we were interested in looking, is it reflected in their strategic plan? You know, do they have actually goals that actually address issues of recruitment and retention of a diverse workforce, providing culturally competent services? Do they have routine assessment of where they are in achieving diversity goals? Do they have a dedicated person, office, or committee with resources to accomplish these goals? And also in terms of showing accountability in reporting to the community where they are in achieving diversity goals. So all of these, we call it the four cornerstones, and I think Jan probably came up with this term, four cornerstones of strategic diversity leadership. Now, what we found was that hospitals that were higher in these attributes also had higher adherence to the KLAS standards. And those hospitals that had higher adherence to the KLAS standards, we have found that have higher scores in terms of patient experiences with care as measured by the CAHPS instruments. So, and not only do they have higher CAHPS scores, but not just for minorities, but across the board for all racial ethnic groups. So it shows the importance of diversity leadership, not just in terms that it is something good to do, but also that it ultimately affects patient experiences. And CMS, you probably are aware that they're moving in the direction of actually rewarding slash penalizing hospitals that do not do well in CAHPS scores. So it will become more and more important for hospitals to pay attention to patient experiences with care. For those of you who do not know the term CAHPS, it's the whole consumer assessments of healthcare providers and system, which has a whole family of survey instruments. Finally, I want to talk about the National Quality Forum. They have come up with a framework that builds actually on the KLAS standards in looking at seven domains of basically cultural competency. Again, we start with leadership, but it's also important to integrate diversity and cultural competency throughout the organization. It should be part of your human resources. It should be part of your information technology, your IT structure. So it's the idea of infusing it throughout the organization. And then you have the other domains like patient-provider communication, care delivery and supporting mechanisms, workforce diversity and training, community engagement, and data collection, public accountability, and quality improvement. A lot of these have subdomains, so if you're interested in looking more at this framework, you can visit qualityforum.org and get more information. There's going to be another step in the process of developing measures to go along with these domains as well. And Jan will now present the framework that she was referring to earlier.
So I'm going to close off this presentation then with a little discussion about what it is we mean by the systems approach just generally and how we operationalize that for this particular application of testing out whether or not you're compliant with the Joint Commission standards and enabling the organization to do so. Rob and I both are working with the National Center for Healthcare Leadership on a couple of different projects, including the one that we'll talk about during our next presentation. But this is the NCHL's overall framework. It's a not-for-profit research and education organization. It was actually formed, it seems to me, it was 9 or 10 years ago. And the purpose of it is to, they have a giant worthy goal, which is to transform leadership in healthcare organizations so that we stop thinking of ourselves as administrators and more think of ourselves as leaders who drive change and drive action and create a context for other people to be able to do the same. So their overall notion is that governance of the organization ought to be a major driver of a process that integrates strategy with leadership development, and by doing so, that will impact upon outcomes and provide the outcomes that we're looking for, and that all of this process happens through a talent management system that is also an integrative process, so that strategy should relate to the leadership development should then drive outcomes. And certainly Rob and I are both advocates of diversity leadership being a major consideration in this entire process. So what we recommend with regards to these new joint commission standards for organizations is, first of all, assess where you are now. I believe that it's pretty impossible to know where we're going if we don't know where we're starting. I know I find that difficult if I'm standing in the middle of the street and I'm clueless about what street I'm on, where's north, south, east, west. I not only have to know the destination that I want, the Joint Commission standards I think help give us a notion of destination, but we have to know where we begin. So we have two instruments. So one is proprietary to the NCHL, that's their diversity leadership assessment. And it focuses on leadership and the infrastructure for diversity management. It has much more of a human resource focus than the second instrument, which includes human resource and leadership measures, which is the CCAF that Rob mentioned a bit earlier. It's the cultural competency assessment tool for hospitals. Rob was principal investigator and I was co-investigator of a project that Guadalupe Pacheco was program officer for, where we developed the CCAF, and it assesses compliance with the class standards. One of the things we did with the CCAF, though, is the class standards themselves were not very specific in terms of leadership and human resource management. We did a comprehensive review of the literature and best practices and focused particular items on evidence-based best practices. So the CCAF will not only look at the class standards, it will also drill down to specific practices that are associated with best practices for the organization at large, particularly in terms of leadership and human resource management. So after that baseline assessment, we recommend mapping your results to the proposed standards, as well as models of best demonstrated practices like the NQF voluntary consensus standards that Rob identified earlier. After you've done that and can identify your gaps, very similar approach that Sandy did, which also is systems approach, you can then do something about your gaps. So know where you've started, know where you want to end up, identify the gaps in terms of where you are, and then develop and implement an action plan to actually close those gaps. Of course, none of this happens without leadership commitment from the top down. Another look at the process of what this looks like in action is a three-part process: enable, cultivate, and reinforce. So starting out with enable, it's extraordinarily important, no matter how much I might want to do my job, if I don't have an infrastructure provided by my organization that facilitates my doing it, I'm not going to do as good a job as I would otherwise. So we think it's extraordinarily important that organizations look at their policies. What is their diversity talk? Look at their procedures. What are they actually doing in terms of diversity leadership? Look at their plant and their technology. What does it look like? What data are they gathering? What do the physical images look like in the hospital? How or other organization? How big are the waiting rooms? So what is it that they're doing to make people feel welcome, and are they considering culture in doing that? As well as look at their people. We'll probably never, thank God for me, I'm glad to live in a society that's multi-ethnic, multicultural. I would never want all my caregivers to be from my same ethnic group. That isn't a desire that I would have. I also don't think it's ever going to be achievable for any of us that we're ever going to be treated completely by a team that's absolutely like us, same sexual orientation, same religion, same gender, same race, same ethnicity. That's not my dream. I don't think it's America's dream. So we'll never have concordance completely, but we certainly want to aim for a different kind of concordance than we have now, a different kind of representation, a removal of some of those disparities that we see in career accomplishment and satisfaction in healthcare. But at the same time, I believe that it is possible for any one of us, no matter what our race, our ethnicity, our religion, our generation, our sexual orientation, to become culturally competent. But we do that through a process, and that's a process of enabling and cultivating on the top part of the organization. These are four practices that are consistently associated with high-performing organizations. If you look, for instance, at the Diversity Inc. Top 50 organizations, some of which are healthcare organizations now, finally. The Kaiser Health System has been on the top 50 list for many years, and the Henry Ford Health System is now on the Diversity Inc. Top 50 list. These are four practices that any institution that wants to cultivate cultural competence needs to consider, and I believe needs to have in place. One is formal mentoring programs. So have a formal process for mentoring to occur, because if you don't, what will happen is like will mentor like. People will pick people like themselves to mentor. And unfortunately, we're still evolving to a point where we're defining who's like us based on values rather than who's like us based on externalities. Second, professional development and training. I believe that diversity training ought to be a big part of that, and training that goes beyond just teaching us markers of other cultures, but rather training that helps us understand ourselves. Who are we culturally? How do we experience our own culture? Because it is certainly possible for me to be biased against people of my own religion, my own culture, my own sexual orientation, as a consequence of the way I experience my own identity. So it's extraordinarily important that we start to explore ourselves and personalize diversity training, which is a challenge to do in the workplace, but the organizations that I've seen do it have an atmosphere that is palpably positive from the moment you walk in the door. Work-life balance and flexible benefits, particularly important for any kind of cultural difference, but especially gender and generational differences. And last, employee resource groups, a way for people who share like identities or who want to learn more and associate and affiliate with identities in which they don't have personal membership, is also a very, very important practice. And last, reinforcement. What we don't measure, we don't focus on, and I believe if we don't measure something, it's an indicator that we really don't care about it. So I think it's extraordinarily important that we have metrics, that we measure our accomplishment against metrics that we've set for ourselves, and that we indicate that through those four cornerstone practices that Rob mentioned in his presentation earlier.